So, just to start off the interview, if you could give me your full name and date of birth.
Right, it's Martin Reginald Baker, and it was the 8th of September 1939.
Okay, and I'm Claire Coyne interviewing Martin Baker for the Temple of Mithras Project. We're at the Bloomberg offices in Finsbury Square, and it's Wednesday, the 17th of September 2014. Okay, and whereabouts were you born?
I was born in a hospital in Woolwich, which at that time they had this sort of mothers and babies hospital where the mothers had to go for to give birth. But I lived in Bexley Heath.
Okay. And could you just say very briefly what your dad did for his working life and whether your mum did any work at all?
Yes, my father was an engineer. He worked at a company called Harveys in Charlton, which is close to Woolwich. And he was a time and motion engineer. He'd been trained at a technical college. And he was a difficulty. He wasn't exactly a works manager, he was a sort of superintendent, as I understand it, in a sheet metal division of this particular company, and they made holes in metal of all thicknesses, including enormously thick metal. I mean, they had monstrous great things which slammed down and made great big holes, which I used to be fascinated. As a lad, I used to go with him to work sometimes. Perhaps he was got some special job on a weekend, and I would go and have a look, and it fascinated me what they would do with metal. But it not didn't fascinate me enough to want to do it myself, if you put
Okay.
it that way.
And what about your mum?
My
Did she do
mother,
any?
yes, she, well, it was rather strange actually, as I understand it. She worked for a company called C&A, which was a fashion and what house, fashion, C&A Modes, I think it was. I believe it was a Dutch company. They're no longer in this in this country. I did see them in France though when I was there recently, but they've gone. She worked in Lewisham. She was the chief cashier at the company before she was married. Then when she got married in, I think it was 1937, they sacked her. They did not employ married women. And then a couple of years later, when she was expecting me, they contacted her and said they'd changed their policy. They built a new shop in Oxford Street, I think. Would she please come and be the chief cashier in Oxford Street? And she said, "So sorry, I'm pregnant." And that was the end of that. And she never went back.
Okay.
After that, she did the odd part-time job in a sweet shop or that sort of thing, but no full-time works until she was close to retirement age, or my father had retired, in which case she needed to go and to earn some money because he'd retired and the pension he had was very poor. So she got a job with the Ministry of Defence, a clerical job in a local place in Lea Green area, I believe, or Eltham, somewhere like that.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. It's just it's lovely to have a little bit of context for the people we're
She
chatting with.
died a couple of years ago now. She was 98, so she did quite well.
Good
My
genes
father
by the sounds of it.
died much earlier. He was in his early 60s when he died, sadly, but he had, let's say, burnt the candle at both ends.
Okay. Well, thanks for that. So let's go into the well, not literally into the Temple of Mithras, but let's start off with your, I guess, your main memory of the Temple of Mithras.
Unfortunately, it is rather vague. I do know that it was extremely famous at the point where they dug up the head of Mithras, which identified what the temple was, of course. He wears, I think it was called a Phrygian cap. A sort of you won't see that, obviously. A Phrygian cap, I think. They dug up this head, and it was in all the papers and so on. And as it happened, I used to deliver papers at that time when I was at school, and so of course I saw it immediately as soon as it appeared on the front page of whatever paper it was, and determined that I must go and see this because I'd always been interested in archaeology since as far as I could remember. So I queued round the block. Now what I can't remember is the time of year.
I can help you with that, because it was September, October.
Well,
end of September, early October.
So in that case, it wasn't school holiday, probably. So it was probably a weekend when I went to see the thing, because otherwise I would have been at school. Wasn't school holidays, as I say. So it must have been a weekend. I queued around the block. Couldn't really see anything because it was shielded off, as far as I remember, but eventually got in. Now, what in my vague memory is surprising to me is that we seem to be almost on a level with it. So, whereas nowadays, if you look at a Roman site, it's about 20 feet down. If you visit the site.
That's interesting you say that, because let me show you this photo, because
So there must have been an access down to the level of the excavation.
I'm not sure about that. Let me see if this jogs any memories.
Because the last big one I went to in Proctor Street.
Well, that's one picture.
Yeah, last big one I went to in Proctor Street, it was getting on for 20 feet down. It was the Eastern Roman Cemetery. And it was... Yeah, see, this is quite shallow, isn't it?
Well,
that is how I remember. That is how I remember it. So, yeah, we could get down. Yes, I mean, if you look at the background, it is quite a long way. It's a big open site, so they must have allowed us down to almost the level. I don't recall we actually walking on the site. I can remember looking into it from the side, but not. These people appear to be. Actually in the site, walking around in it, which is, that wouldn't happen nowadays.
Well, actually, what they did was they did erect some walkways, but I'm looking for a picture for those.
Yeah.
So that was before it had caught.
So they obviously, when I went to the Proctor Street site, which was a couple of years ago now, we were up at this level and looking down into the site, because it, as I say, that was getting on for 20 feet down. But here, they must have let us down onto this level, because I don't remember looking down on it, put it that way.
Well, there's a picture that shows, what they did do was they built more of a walkway and made it a lot more organised. This was on the very first day almost that the public turned up, before many people knew about it. I've got a picture that shows that.
Wow. Sure. I remember the curved end, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall, they didn't show us any finds.
No.
Just the actual... Yeah, so this is where we would have queued round. I might even be on this in this picture, you never know. If you see a little blonde lad.
It's probably you.
It's probably me.
So do you know who you went with?
No, by myself, as far as I know.
Mm. And can you remember anything? If you can't remember the time of year, I suppose you don't remember the weather or anything.
No, sadly. As I say, I certainly remember this queue, going all round the site and eventually getting down into the site. And I certainly didn't go with my parents or anything. And as far as I recall... It wasn't any school friends either that I went with. I can remember the Walbrook, because I was interested in the fact that it was right by the old river, the Walbrook, which is where they've been excavating more recently, of course. So
maybe tell me, Martin, a bit more about you said you'd always had an interest in archaeology.
Yes, I as a sad little child, perhaps, I had some books, one of which was called The Wonder Book of Wonders, which you may have come across, but it's not in publication now, I don't think. And one of the areas in this particular Book of Wonders was of the wonders of the world, of the ancient world, and I learned those off by heart and probably still remember them. The seven wonders of the ancient world. Not that I could ever visit them, I didn't think, but at least, you know, it was fascinating to me, these extraordinary places, and the only one that was left was the Great Pyramid at Giza. And I thought, well, one day I might be able to go and visit that, but the rest of them are gone forever. And that was a sort of an interest which I had in the ancient world and in history and that sort of thing. And when I was at school, we formed a natural, they'd already formed a natural history society. And we used to go out on rambles and all the rest of it. And one of the places we went to was Chislehurst Caves when I was about 13, I suppose. And we got to know the people down there, and they persuaded us to do a sort of informal archaeological dig down in the caves. There were tunnels there that were blocked by earth, and they wanted to explore these tunnels. So they provided us with hard hats and jelly mould lights on the front, so we like little miners, and we actually dug in these tunnels and came up with a number of bones which went up to the British Museum for identification. Turned out they were possibly Iron Age, and we even had the Daily Mirror came down and took photographs of us working, and we thought it was very thrilling, of course, you know.
But you didn't do any digging at the Temple of Mithras?
No, nobody, well, as far as I was aware, nobody was allowed to do anything other than look at it. But that would have been wonderful if I could have done.
We've had this ticket sent in by somebody who, it's the ticket belonged not to the person that sent it in, but to a relative. So we're trying to find out more about that, but it doesn't ring any bells.
I didn't have a ticket. I just queued and got in. As far as I know, I mean, perhaps this was something which was provided to companies in the area or something like that for their employees.
Well, there's an accompanying letter that somebody wrote and left with a ticket for somebody.
Well, I certainly didn't get a ticket. No. No, I just queued round the block. And got in, so perhaps I was lucky, but no, I certainly didn't have a ticket. That may have been later, of course, I don't know, when it was more formal. All I remember is just queuing and going in, seeing it, being amazed that it was there, and then seeing bits in the paper afterwards, and as I say, the Giles cartoon of the chap digging in his allotment and throwing out Mithras heads and swearing. Saying flipping Mithras heads, you know, big pile by his allotment. But that was just the joke at the time. But after that, I suppose I didn't really... I thought I would go to university and study archaeology, but I was persuaded by my father that I would never earn a living doing that, and that it wasn't a good idea, and I should concentrate on sciences. Which I did at school, and ended up doing A levels in zoology and botany and physics and chemistry and that sort of thing, and planned to go to London University to do geology, which was the nearest thing I could get to the archaeology, if you like, and which my parents thought was perhaps more suitable. And I was interested in geology as well. I always have been, still am. So that was okay. it didn't work out in the end. I didn't pass the necessary number of A-levels, and had to leave school and try and get the A-level that I'd failed at evening classes at Woolwich Polytechnic, which I did, but I failed the one that I'd already got. I had to take the two or three again. And because I didn't get them all at the same time, they refused the place. It was at Queen Mary College in East London. And that was it. End of choices. Because at that time, people of my age, I had already been deferred for a year, had to do national service and go into the military. And as soon as I failed and lost my place, I had to go. Put in the Air Force.
Okay.
For 2 years.
But throughout all of that, and then through the rest of your life, you've maintained this passion for archaeology.
Oh yeah, as best I could. Of course, the problem is you go into something like the Air Force for 2 years. They sent me to the Far East. I forgot, if you like, any possibility of taking these A levels again, and pursuing my original course. It wasn't helped by being stuck in the Far East, possibly in Singapore and Hong Kong. And when I came back, I went to the local labour exchange, which I'd actually worked at briefly while I was doing my evening classes. Went back to the labour exchange and said, you know, here I am again, you know, I need a job, I have no idea what I'm going to do. And they said, well, come back in here while you're thinking about it. And so I worked for what was the Ministry of Labour then.
Okay.
And I stayed with them. It became Department of Employment, and eventually I was in the Industrial Relations Division, and they decided to set up ACAS as an independent organisation to deal with industrial relations problems.
I'm going to bring you back to the archaeology,
sure,
if that's all right.
But the archaeology was a matter of reading, reading books. And I mean, I liked the television going back to the early days. My favourite television programme was probably Animal, Vegetable and Mineral, with Sir Mortimer Wheeler and others. Which was objects which had been found, and he was quite famous for every so often when an object appeared, he'd say, oh, I was there when we dug that up. And I thought, you know, that was fascinating. And I read any books that I could that seemed interesting, you know, and I collected books and I collected objects as well. You know, I, even as a lad, when I had a paper round, I used to spend my pocket money in the local junk shop on ancient artifacts, if I could find them, you know, Chinese carvings, all sorts of things. And so I did start to build up a collection. One thing that eluded me for many years was a Stone Age axe, but eventually I got one.
Got it, that's
so
wonderful.
I have a small collection of those now.
So if you were, I know it's not an easy thing to do, but if you were to try and define what it is that archaeology means to you and why it speaks to you so much, what would you say?
Two things, I suppose. It's about people that I've discovered. In the early days, it was about objects for me. I was fascinated with these objects which had been made by hand thousands of years ago and had survived, and you could handle them and it made a connection. But in later life, I've realised that connection is actually with people, the people who made it. It's not the objects which is important. And that is what archaeology is about now. It's not about the objects. The objects are a means to an end, a means to dating or whatever. Even things like Mithras Temple is an object, if you like. It's something which has been left behind. But what's important is what it meant to the people at the time and why it was there. And that's the important thing that you learn when you get something like that, that this was an imported religion which had been brought by the military. It was a sort of secret society religion almost, from the Middle East. And the Roman army, which had been in the Middle East, of course, picked up the religion and brought it with them. But it tells you about the people. That's the important thing.
That's a lovely summary, actually. So if you were, say you were, I don't know, talking to a niece or a nephew or, you know, a child or a teenager, what would you want to sort of pass on to them about archaeology?
There are several aspects to archaeology. Of course, the aspect that people think of most is trenches, and people down in trenches with little trowels and digging away. And I would say to them, you know, if you do nothing else, if you have a go at that, that's a jolly good start, because it's a fascinating activity. It's extremely relaxing, apart from anything else, and you focus completely on what you're doing, and everything else disappears, and you focus on this space in front of you that you're perhaps troweling. And, you know, it's human nature to want to find things. And for a child, that is the important thing. They can later on, you can come to the sort of higher aspects of understanding people and cultures and all the rest of it. But initially, finding objects and understanding what they were used for and actually handling them and seeing how they were made, is quite important, and for a young person that is the easiest way to approach it, I think.
That's lovely. And so, thinking about the Temple of Mithras, you talked about the origins of the religion. When you were there yourself looking at the site, was there anything particularly about Mithras, the religion itself, that sparked your imagination, or was it more the stones?
Didn't know anything about it.
Okay.
At that time, Mithras was a Roman god that I'd never heard of. But the fact that a Roman temple was sitting there in the city of London, that was the exciting thing for me. You know, we learned in history at school about the Romans being here. We knew about a Roman villa. I mean, the nearest one we had to where I was is Lullingstone in Kent, near Farningham, and that was a fairly new find at the time, and they were still excavating it. So we knew the Romans were here or had been here. We knew they'd been in Kent. I knew they'd been in London. I knew that the city of London was founded by the Romans pretty well, and that the original walls were theirs. But it was very difficult to actually see it. This was something which was very tangible. Suddenly, here it was, right in front of us, under the ground. And I think a lot of people woke up to the fact that you didn't have to dig very far, virtually anywhere in the city of London area, and you would hit Rome, or at least the remains of the Roman Empire. And that was the astonishing thing for me, I think. It was there.
So that's really interesting, because thinking about the vast numbers of people that seem to visit the site, you know, one figure that we think is more or less accurate is 30,000 people a day over a 2-week period. What's your take on why it drew such large crowds?
It was the first time anything like that, as far as I'm aware, had been found in the city of London. I mean, and it got such huge publicity. Well, you can see, it's a front page thing. It got enormous publicity. And it was something unique. Nobody had ever seen anything like it before, not in London. I mean, all right, you'd go to Bath and those sort of places, where they had the Roman baths and so on, at least what was left of them. But to find a temple almost intact, like there under the streets of London, was quite extraordinary, I think, and still is, I think. You know, it's the only visible thing that most people have ever seen, I think, of Rome in London, apart from going into a museum and seeing the artifacts, because it's been built over so much. Even now, I know that there are the odd Roman baths, but they're tucked away under buildings and nobody ever sees them. This was the only one, as far as I'm aware, that has ever been seen. There it was.
And did you go and visit it later once it was moved?
No. I visited the Museum of London and looked at the artefacts in time, but I didn't go and visit again. Time had passed, I suppose. I was no longer going to be an archaeologist. I went into the Air Force, I did my service, I then got a job. Got settled into a job, I got married, I had children, a mortgage and all the rest of it. I didn't forget archaeology, I still read books and anything which came up in the papers about it. But I put aside any thoughts of actually doing it or getting in any way involved. I took the children to museums once they were old enough to go and appreciate it, and they were bored to death. None of them, I had two boys, they've never shared my interest, sadly, and neither do my grandchildren, sadly. It was put on the back burner, so I think is the expression, for many years.
But you're chair now, aren't you, of the Bexley
Archaeological Society? Oh yeah, well what happened was, I mean, how it all came about, I mean, it's I've always thought life is my life anyway, is compartmentalised. I was at school, I was in the Air Force, I got a job, I got promoted to different versions of that job. I went and worked for different people within the organisation. And then I retired and set up an antique business with my wife. And for some years we ran an antique business, had our own shop in New Eltham. And then she died. We closed the shop in 2004. Because business was so bad, we were losing money. And for the first time, we were completely retired. We had no jobs to do, if you like, and no work, because running an antique shop was hard work. And we were fully retired, and a year later she died. Completely, suddenly, out of the blue, no warning, no nothing. And I was bit adrift, you might say. Didn't know what to do, but we had become quite friendly with the owners of a local pub that we used to lunch in when we were out looking for stock and so on, and my wife had become very friendly with the lady who owned the pub. She used to do all the flowers for the pub, and so as a voluntary thing she loved doing flowers. So all the outside of the pub got decorated every summer. But I did know that an archaeologist was also a customer at the pub, and I asked my friend, the landlady, to introduce me. I was introduced, discovered that there was this group locally, the Bexley Archaeological Group, and said, can I join? Because I need something to do quick. And I was straight in there, and I was on my knees in a trench before I knew where I was, with a small trowel in my hand, and it was extremely superb therapy, which I needed, obviously. And I decided that if I was going to do this, I needed to be serious about it. And I discovered that at a local evening school, they were running O-level and A-level classes in Egypt, in archaeology, including Egyptology. So I discussed it with the tutor and decided I would go straight for the A-level, which I did. So I did evening classes for about 3 years and did AS and A2 and got my A-levels. Became fascinated with Egyptology, got all the books I could, learnt to read hieroglyphs, and when the Tutankhamun exhibition came to the O2, I went with the tutor. She was disabled, so I pushed her around in a wheelchair, and we were going up to the various exhibits, translating them together, and got quite a crowd round us while we were doing it, as you can imagine. Anyway, I really sort of got myself sunk into the Bexley Archaeological Group, very enthusiastic, very keen. And we were out on a trip one day, and the chair, current chair of the group, I'd only been in with them in 2 years, I think, she came up to me and said, look, she was thinking of giving up the chair, would I be prepared to be proposed for it for the next AGM? And I said, well, only if somebody else is, because I've only just joined the group, you know. Needless to say, nobody else put their name forward, and I got elected without any opposition. Which I said, well, fair enough, I need plenty to do, so I'll take it on, and which I did. And so I've now been the chair for about 5-6 years now. And suits me fine, you know. And we also, in the several things I've wanted to do once I got the chair, with the group, I want the site that we use in North Cray, I wanted to buy it. And I kept approaching the owners, and eventually they said, well, you can't buy it, but we'll give you a 5-year lease. So I've now signed a 5-year lease on our site, which is the remains of almshouses in North Cray, or at least their back gardens. But it's a site which has produced everything from the Neolithic to the 20th century. So we use it now for training. We teach archaeology on site. We have an annual training dig every year. And the other thing which I was very keen to do was to outreach to children, to schools and so on. I wrote to all the headmasters locally, offered our services in teaching the children, and was completely ignored. But eventually we discovered, well, I knew that the Council for British Archaeology were running a young archaeologist club nationally. But they were also encouraging local areas to set up their own groups. And so I thought about this, I talked to the council. They said, well, you will need people who are really committed to run it. And I just didn't have anybody in the group who could run it. But eventually I got two teachers joined our group. And I approached them and said, would you be prepared to take it on? And they said yes. So it took us about 2 years, but eventually, after all the necessary paperwork, we managed to get approval from the council in York to set up this group. And we publicised it, and before we knew, we got 50 members. And it's going strong, our young archaeologist club for Bexley. In fact, we've got people from outside the Bexley boundary, you know, because there isn't another one until you get down to sort of perhaps Maidstone Way, or there is one in the City of London, but there's no others in our area. So that I was very pleased about that. I thought, if I've done nothing else, I've achieved that for the group, that we've got this, well, we've got the site for 5 years, and we've got the young archaeologist group, and we have them on site, and we take them to visits, we take them on the foreshore of the Thames, we do all sorts of things with them. But I say, every year we have an adult training dig for 1 week, usually end of July, August, on site. So at least now we've got the lease of the site, we can keep doing that. And we've had people of all ages come and spend a whole week with us, up to a dozen people, and we give them a concentrated training for a week. And they do everything from digging to surveying to field walking and all sorts of things. Finds identification, how to draw finds for publication, that sort of thing. And very successful, and some of our people have actually gone on to university, and funny enough, I got an email yesterday with pictures of a Polish girl in her graduation robes, who was on our training dig about 3-4 years ago, Olga.
That's so wonderful, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and she went on, she was at Birkbeck College, and she's just graduated. And so I got the email yesterday with a picture, all the pictures, you know. That's good. Yeah.
It's funny how archaeology is sort of bookended, you know, that you as a child and a teenager with that passion, and now in the autumn of your life.
Oh, exactly, yes. Yeah. And I'm still fit enough to do it, which I'm very grateful for. You know, I can still do it. I can still hold my own and help wherever I can. You know, I mean, I still get in a trench and dig. And also I work with the Thames Discovery Programme. And the Thames Discovery Programme, we have sites along the Thames which we visit when required. They have a program of visiting between Richmond and Erith, and local groups who've been trained for the Thames Discovery Program. I mean, they're not all archaeologists, they're just trained to observe the foreshore and to draw whatever is there, and take photographs and measure, that sort of thing. It's a matter of not preserving what's there on the foreshore, it's a matter of recording, because most of it can't be preserved. It disappears with the next tide even. But at least we can record what appears and what disappears. And through them, quite recently, I was contacted and said some people need some help. Mola needs some help at Charterhouse Square. There's a community dig, and they need somebody each day to supervise the actual volunteers who come in from the surrounding area. And so I said, yeah, I can do that. And I went along and supervised two groups, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, of complete, complete amateurs. And they loved it. One couple that I had in the afternoon, they lived in the Barbican overlooking the site. So they were delighted to get involved in this dig. Charterhouse Square is connected with the local monastery. I think it's a monastery or a friary, I'm not sure exactly which. It was a community dig which they'd organised with Mola, and which I was very happy to get involved
Sounds
with.
That's great. Yeah. So can I just go back to your Young Archaeologists Club? What's the age range?
8 to 16.
Okay.
And because of that, of course, we all have to go through all the hoops to make sure that we don't have any criminal records. And funnily enough, it's every 3 years we have to be checked again, and I've just got the paperwork through for me to complete again. That all has to go off to the Council for British Archaeology, and where they have to check with the police that we're still, you know, have a clean record. And what I didn't appreciate is that that applies to this particular project that we're a club that we're running, but it doesn't apply to anything else. So if, for example, I'd had a clearance working at a school, that wouldn't count for this club.
You have to
do it each for each one. Luckily, the Council of British Archaeology pays for it, otherwise it could get rather expensive every
so
often.
Yes, it could. I'm just going to check my notes, Martin, see if there's any gaping hole that I've missed, which is quite possible. And maybe I'll just ask you a little bit about the area. Maybe the area of the site.
I can tell you more about that, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I'm particularly interested in this idea that, the site was discovered because Bucklesbury House was being built, and here we are 60 years later, and there's a new building being built right there, which is where Bloomberg comes in, obviously. Thinking about the changes in the area over the decades, or any thoughts you might have on that, really.
Yeah, I didn't know at the time, and in between this sort of gap, if you like, between me thinking about archaeology and then coming back to it, What I hadn't appreciated is that they'd actually moved the thing several times. I know it was under one building originally, but then it got moved. But I understand that it's going back to where it belongs, which I think is exactly what should happen. Not only that, but in the preparation for restoring it to its rightful place, they've discovered even more of it, which perhaps had got missed the first time round, and including some pillars and what have you, and more finds, no doubt. I haven't seen it all yet at the Museum of London. I shall go and have a good look but I know that they've been digging also on the Walbrook itself, on the river, and because of the conditions there, the anaerobic conditions in the mud, the finds that have been found there are quite extraordinary, and leather and wood and all sorts of things apparently, which obviously weren't found the first time round. So it's all connected, no doubt. And we'll throw more light on what was going on around the temple, not just the temple itself. That's quite important. Other than that, I don't know anything. I mean, I do go to the Museum of London from time to time, and I have contacts at the Museum of London through the Thames Discovery Programme, and also from other. It's a funny world, the world of archaeology. It's very linked in, if that's the expression, the modern expression. I mean, I have on my computer, I have a LinkedIn site, and there are quite a few archaeologists on it. But I know, for example, the person who started LARC, which is the London Archaeological Archives Research Centre, John Shepherd. I know John very well. And quite a few other people, Natalie Cohen. I don't expect if you know Natalie Cohen. She's at LARC. She's at MOLA now. She was at UCL, and she's one of the sort of leaders of the Thames Discovery Programme. But she's an archaeologist too. And when the Tower of London site opens once a year, or the foreshore rather, once a year they open up the foreshore. We're there, and I usually, for part of the time, run the outreach table for the public, so that when they all go down, they come back with all the finds and we can talk to them about it. In fact, a couple of years ago, I worked for the BBC on the site, worked for the same occasion. They contacted me and said, look, the BBC are going to be running a stall there. Would you help them, and also go down and interview people on the foreshore and do a recording of the interviews, which will then be held by the Tower of London, I believe. The Tower of London were going to keep, well, what they did with them afterwards, I don't know. But we did that. I went down with a colleague from BBC, and we actually interviewed children about what they'd found and what they thought it was, and so on. Only by sound, only with sound. We didn't do any televising. Yeah. But that, presumably, those interviews are held somewhere in the city, in the Tower of London, on their archives. Mm. So, yeah.
Golly. Well, it's amazing because I think we're probably more or less done now in terms of talking about the Temple of Mithras, but just what's come up for me is, you know, how much archaeology in the end has become your life after being very passionate
among
about
other
it,
things.
But it sounds like
I teach at home antiques appreciation, world antiques, for the University of the Third Age, which you may have heard sort of over 50s, and I have about 3 groups a month. And my house is a bit like a museum now. And they said I should open it as a museum. It's got so much rubbish in it from all over the world. Yeah. I collect, my own particular passion is Chinese ceramics.
Okay.
So I've got an awful lot, and bronzes and wood carvings and all sorts. So I've got a lot of Chinese stuff. Mm. But I've also got stuff pre-Columbian and African and Indian and British. And I've got a huge collection of flint tools, which come from all over the place. And I lend those out as well.
That sounds very nice of you. Well, just to wrap up, is there anything else that you'd like to say that we haven't touched on? Anything to summarise?
Not as far as the temple is concerned, no. I mean, obviously, once it is re-established, I think I should probably go and have a look. I don't think I could resist it. And obviously, once the finds are processed, which will take a very long time, no doubt, from the new site, at the Museum of London, I should go and have a look at those as well. Other than that, no, I don't think there's anything else I can add.
Okay, well, it's been wonderful hearing you talk about all your experiences of archaeology. And you said you didn't have that many memories from the site, but it actually just feels like
it's
a gateway.
It's such a long time ago.
Yeah, but I don't, you know, I think that's... Yeah. It's interesting hearing about you seeing the picture in the newspaper as a lad on your newspaper round.
Yeah.
You know, all of that adds colour to this, you know, this picture of what was happening at the time and how people experienced it and came to it.
Yeah,
you know?
Because I don't think we had a television, for example, at the time. Now, no doubt on the television news... We because 53 was the coronation, and I recall we went to a friend's of my father's to see the coronation on his little black and white television, and we didn't have a television, so I'm sure by 54 we wouldn't have had a television, so I wouldn't have found out that way, and it must have been the newspaper, you know, because as I say, I had every day before school, I was up at sort of 6 o'clock and doing my newspaper round for pocket money, and then off to school, which took a long time to get to as well. From where I lived in Lee Green, I had to get to New Cross by tram, which used to break down regularly. So it was a bit, you know, it was necessary, let's say. If I had the choice, I probably wouldn't have done a paper round and tried to squeeze that in before going to school.
Yeah.
But I didn't have a choice because I had no other source of pocket money. So that's where I would have seen it. I mean, when I see that picture of the Telegraph, of the Mail rather, with that photograph, I mean, I could almost... No, I can't say I remember that, but I'm pretty sure that's something like that. It would have made me get up and go. I couldn't resist it.
Well, that seems like a perfect note to end on. So thank you so much.
Oh, okay.
That was really lovely.
Good.